were impressive.
That's impressive, too.
I like that.
House Labor Commerce will now come to order. It's 4:05 p.m. on leap year, February 29th, 1912. Leap day. With us, we have Speaker Chenault, Representative Thompson, Representative Sadler, Representative Johnson, Representative Holmes, and I think we're missing one, but I think he's probably going to show up. Budget Subcommittee is my guess. Mm-hmm. I'd like to apologize to anybody that either inside the room or out at the LIOs. We've been pushed back an hour by both floor session and the previous committee, and so we're about 45 minutes late in getting started. Please silence, or even better, turn off your BlackBerry cell phones, iPhones, whatever. iPads are okay for the people sitting at the front table. We have two bills on the calendar today. House Bill 292, Principal and Income Act et al., short version title. Jane, are you going to be carrying it, or Representative Thompson, or both? I guess that narrows it down.
That was an answer.
We know how things roll.
Jennifer Olson, House Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm really going to back off this one. We have Dave Schaftel online, and I think the easiest way to do this bill is to have him run us through the sectional so questions can be asked.
Oh, you can give us a brief summary.
Okay, I'll read you the title.
please state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. And this bill before you today is the trust bill for this year. It's an act relating to property exemptions from retirement plans, individual retirement account, Roth IRAs relating to pleadings, orders, liability, and notices under the Uniform Probate Code, relating to the appointment of trust property, relating to the Alaska Principal Income Act, relating to the Alaska Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, relating to the disposition of human remains, relating to insurable interests of life insurance policies, relating to transfers of individual retirement plans, relating to the community property of married persons, and amending Rule 301A of the Alaska Rules of Evidence. And this bill is rather in depth and touches on a lot of parts of Title 13. But it is all under Title 13, and I think the easiest thing is for Mr. Schaftel to walk us through the sectional.
Oh, we're not done with you yet, though.
Oh.
Any questions for Jane? Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chairman, Jane's a friend. I want her to remain so.
Mr. Chairman, well, make sure she continues to work for me also.
Okay. We'll let her off light. I think I owe her something from someplace. But,
I'm sure.
With that, I think we'll go to Dave Schaftel, who I think all of us remember from previous bills. Dave, you want to state your name and affiliation for the record? Do you want to tell us what this bill really does?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Olson. My name is Dave Schaftel. I'm an attorney in private practice in Anchorage. I work in the estate and trusts area, estate planning and estate and trust administration. I'm a member of an informal group of attorneys who work in the same area and trust officers who have worked with the legislature for now over probably 14 years or so, 14, 15 years, to make recommendations to the legislature in this area of trust and estates in order to improve Alaska's law in this area, and the legislature has done a very substantial amount of work here and really has the, we are considered the leader in this area around the country, and you know, they say imitation is the highest form of flattery. A lot of states have copied our laws, and of course we do the same with them, and this is a very dynamic area across the country with other states constantly trying to improve their law. This area affects almost everyone at one time in their lifetime, if not more often. So when we improve our laws in this area, and the legislature does, it really is helping all the residents of the state of Alaska. This is a particularly good and thorough bill. It covers a number of what probably you could call bread and butter subjects. I mean, just very significant subjects. There's nothing really very exotic in them for the most part, but they're the kinds of things that will affect many, many families. The first provision, just to run you through the sectional analysis, Section 1 deals with asset protection for inherited retirement plans. Retirement plans are protected from the creditors of the employee, the participant in the plan, both under federal and state law, and they have been under Alaska law since the mid-80s. What has happened more recently is both under federal law and the bankruptcy courts, and under starting under the state courts now, they've extended this protection to the beneficiaries of a retirement plan. So, for example, a husband has an IRA or a retirement interest that is he has earned over his years and working, and the husband passes away and names his wife as the beneficiary of the plan. Then the wife's interest in that plan is protected from her creditors. This is now the majority rule in the federal courts and bankruptcy court. There are 12 decisions that where bankruptcy courts around the country have enacted this type of protection under the bankruptcy code. Arizona, Florida, and Texas have enacted similar provisions to the one you have before you. Section 2 is a conforming amendment for Section 28. Section 3 is a definitional changes relating to the provision I just described. Section 4 deals with settlement agreements and representation for settlement agreements.
Dave, will you take the
common just practical problems when you have a settlement agreement, whether it's in front of a court or if it's done outside of the court, is that
Dave?
They need to provide representation for minors, incapacitated persons.
Dave?
Themselves. And we have, Alaska has a very good statute already that allows someone with similar interests, for example, a parent, to represent her minor children in a settlement agreement. The problem we saw with our existing statute is it's pretty clear that it applies to judicial proceedings.
Dave, can you hear me?
Yep.
Dave, what I'd like to do is stop at the end of each section so we can do the questions as when we still have the section fresh in our minds. So I think we can probably do that with Section 4. We have at least one question, I believe, on Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, I had a question briefly on Section 1, the asset protection of inherited retirement plans. You gave the example of a surviving spouse or a widow's interest in that their husband's IRA would be protected. What about in the cases where the children are also partial beneficiaries of an IRA? I've got investments where my wife is primary, or actually is one quarter, one quarter, one quarter. Does the protection apply to each beneficiary or just to spouses?
Through the chair, it would apply to each beneficiary.
Okay. Thank you.
Please continue.
So, again, looking at this settlement agreements, what Section 4 and Section 5 do is make it clear that this type of representation will apply to settlement agreements that are made outside of a judicial setting. For example, if you have a trust and a trustee renders an accounting, that the mother in my example can approve that accounting both for herself and for her minor children, and it's binding on the minor children when they are adults because her interest is the same as theirs. Her interest has to be the same or very similar for her to do this kind of representation under our statute. So this is a clarification provision for Alaska Statute 1306-120. Are there any questions on
yeah,
that?
We've got at least one question. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. When you say the same interest, you mean the same class of interest or an equivalent monetary interest? How do you define what is the same interest?
Representative Sadler, it doesn't have to be the same monetary interest, but essentially the same, to give you an example, the one we've been talking about, if you had different, let's say 50% goes to the surviving spouse and 10% each goes to the surviving five children, three of whom are minors. Well, and then there was a settlement. Let's say there was a challenge to a will, and the spouse decided, well, you know, I think the settlement for this challenge is fair and appropriate, and I'm going to agree to it for myself and for my three minor children. Well, they all would have essentially the same interest there. The interest would be that there's a case, somebody's brought a challenge, somebody is trying to reduce their share, and she is protecting her share. She has the same interest as the interest of the kids, which would be to protect their share. So that's, I guess the best way I can answer is through an example like that. Is that satisfactory, Representative Sadler?
I think so. So it's the same class of interest versus if there was a creditor, just using the previous section, if there were the beneficiaries that were family, there might be creditors or somebody else, I don't know. That does answer my question, yes, thank you.
Now, please continue.
Sections 6 through 8 deal with a type of trust modification that's referred to as decanting that has developed really nationwide in order to correct errors in trusts and to adjust irrevocable trust to change circumstances and new laws. Alaska enacted its decanting statute, which exists under Section 1336.157, and we enacted that back in 1998. At that time, we were the third state to enact that type of law. We copied New York's statute. Since that time, there have been 13 states who have enacted what we call decanting statutes, and there are three other states that have pending statutes. So it's become quite a popular way to deal with correcting problems with irrevocable trusts. New York recently did a wholesale revision, improving very, very substantially its decanting statute, which we had copied earlier, and they did this revision and enacted it in 2011. Our proposed amendment here just closely tracks the changes in this new New York provision. We made certain procedural changes to accommodate references to our laws, but otherwise we're pretty much following the New York revision. Are there questions on this provision?
Nope, you got a pass on that one.
All right. The next one deals with Alaska's Principal and Income Act. This Alaska enacted the uniform, or updated really, the previous version of our uniform Alaska Principal and Income Act in 2003. One of the main aspects of the changes in 2003 is that the new act then created what's called a unit trust approach. Typically, you would have, there are many trusts out there that say, pay all the income to my wife, and then after she dies, pay the remainder to my kids in equal shares, for example. And the problem with that is it created a tension between the surviving spouse and the children. The surviving spouse wanted the assets invested in a way that would produce income. The children wanted the assets invested in a way that would produce equity growth. And so, for example, it might be the spouse would want investments in bonds and the children would want investments in stocks. At least that was the time when stocks grew in value. Hopefully they will again here. So we had this tension. And the unit trust concept was developed to alleviate that tension. What it says is instead of saying pay all the income to the surviving spouse, pay a percentage of the total assets that exist at the beginning of the year to that spouse. For example, a 4% interest. So that way, if equities, if stocks were the right thing to invest in to get the best return, you could invest in equities and then just sell 4% of them every year and pay that amount to the surviving spouse. Now, so these, this unit trust concept was enacted, and over the years, the Internal Revenue Service has enacted regulations relating to the unit trust. There's been experience nationwide with them, and we have worked with an attorney who's a specialist in this area back in Philadelphia. He's recommended changes to update our version. These changes allow a trustee to choose a unit trust rate without going to court, that give the trustee more leeway. It can be between 3 and 5%. It doesn't have to be just limited to 4%. The changes provide a better definition of income. They provide an ordering for distributions among the types of income and principal. In other words, capital gain, ordinary income, return of principal. They provide what's called a smoothing period of up to 5 years for determining the amount of assets. So in order, so you don't have ups and downs, you take an average over the last 5 years of the value of the assets in the trust, and then you apply the percentage to that average. They clarify that this unit trust method can apply to retirement benefits as well. So these changes will just facilitate the use of this unit trust concept in Alaska law for Alaska residents. Any questions on the Uniform Principal and Income Act?
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Dave, would it be fair to say that this is basically making the trust law a little bit more like how a lot of foundations are run? It's basically allowing what we would think of as a percent of market value calculation to be used. Is that a correct analogy?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, yes, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Makes sense to me.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Dave, but that still doesn't resolve the tension between investing for growth or for equity. For growth versus income, it smooths out a little bit with that five year average. So the children might still want it to be invested for long-term growth, while the surviving wife might want it to be in bonds. It doesn't really address that, does it?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I haven't explained it adequately. It does do that. In fact, it did that back in 2003. You're absolutely correct. The amendments I just described to you really didn't focus on that change. But the basic change here is what you can do. Let's say you have an existing trust, and that existing trust says, pay all the income to my wife, and then after she dies, pay the remainder to my three children. Well, that trust can be converted to a unit trust. And so instead of having the tension between having to invest for income or having to invest for equity growth, the trustee now has a direction, and that direction is, let's say, pay 5% every year of the value of the assets in this trust to my wife. Now, that allows the trustee to invest any way that trustee thinks is best to get the best total return. These are called total return unit trusts. So the trustee can invest in equities, in stocks, or can invest in bonds or a mixture. It's just so the spouse, my wife sitting there, will be saying, as long as I get 5%, I don't care how you invest it. I just want to get 5% every year. And I hope you will invest it to get the best total return, whatever mixture you determine is best.
I'd like to butt in briefly to indicate that we've been joined by Representative Miller, and we do have a full committee on hand. Any further questions?
Yeah, and just to
Representative
sure,
Sadler.
And just to clarify that 3-5% election, that's of the total, that's the corpus, that's not just the proceeds.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Please continue.
Now, the next one is an interesting one, provision that actually was initially brought up by one of the representatives in the legislature. And this deals with our Uniform Transfer to Minors Act. Every state law has a Uniform Transfer to Minors provision. And basically what this states is it's kind of an informal way of creating a trust. You can go to a bank or to a brokerage firm and create one of these accounts, and then you can make gifts to these accounts for, let's say, for your child, for your daughter. So you create an account like this, and over the years, you build up substantial assets in this account. Now, the law says, depending upon the way that assets were contributed to the account, but if they were gifts, that when your daughter reaches age 21, she's entitled to the funds. And during the period while she's a minor and up until she's 21, there's a custodian that is named for this account. It may be the person who contributed to it, or it may be someone else. That custodian can spend the money for the benefit, in my example, of the daughter. Now, problems have developed, though. Some of these accounts have been invested very well, and there are very substantial assets in them. And the child reaches the age when amounts are to be distributed outright to her, but she's not ready for those assets. She may have a maturity problem, may not have the experience to handle that amount of funds. It might derail her from going to college or continuing to college or developing her own career. She may have a drug or problem or an alcohol problem that would only be exacerbated if she was given substantial financial funds at that point. So there's been, and this has been a nationwide issue, what do you do in this situation? For tax law reasons, the child has to be given the right to compel a distribution at age 21, in some situations at age 18, depending on how the funds were contributed. But if the child agrees, and often that's the case, then under existing law, the age can be extended to age 25. But there's no reason why it can't be extended beyond that date. It's just that statutes have yet to do that, and this statute does that. This amendment allows the custodian to go and give notice to the child and say, you know, I want to extend this to age 30. And the child has the right at age 21 to compel a distribution, to say no. But if the child agrees, then it will be extended to age 30. And often, it's not always, but often in these situations, the child will recognize that he or she is not ready to manage the funds and is perfectly willing to have them continue to be managed by the custodian. The custodian has a fiduciary duty to manage these for the benefit of the child, as I mentioned before, and for the child's needs. So that's what this amendment does. Are there questions?
Yes. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Is there any outside age limit, you know, 35, 40, 50?
No, there isn't. I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Sadler. No, there isn't in the statute, but again, the longer you would propose to extend this, the more likely the child is going to not agree to it. And so what the statute and amendments do provide is that you can have a series of these. So probably the wiser thing for that custodian to do would be to propose a reasonable extension. And then in my example, when the child reached age 30, If the child was continuing to have problems, is to go back and propose another extension. But remembering all the time that this person, the beneficiary of the child, at age 18, the child is an adult. It's her property. So she does have the right at any of these extension periods to say, no, that's it. I want it distributed out to me outright.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dave. The child, or let's call him a child, or the young adult, has the ability to receive those funds at any time. I mean, it's only the oral agreement or a written agreement between the custodian and the owner of the assets if they extend this time period to a longer date. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, once the assets are in this account, while the child is a minor, let's take that period, there is a custodian. That custodian, there's a detailed statute that says that the custodian is to use those funds for the benefit of that that minor during that period of time. Then when the child, in our example, reaches age 18, or if it's a gift, it's age 21, the child at age 21 has the right to say, give me those assets, but not before that. But at that point, the child has the right to say, give me those assets, just write me a check, we're done. No more uniform transfer to minor account.
Mm-hmm.
If the custodian goes to the child at age 21 and says, I propose we extend this now to age 25, and the child agrees, then during that four-year period, that child cannot demand any assets. The child can go and say to the custodian, I need these for these purposes. And that custodian is a fiduciary. If the child was going to college and needed them for college expenses or trade school or needed them to make a down payment on a house, and the custodian refused unreasonably, that custodian would be violating his or her fiduciary duties, and the child then could get a remedy in court, but can't just demand assets and compel them until age 25. Same thing. If it's extended then to age 30, same situation. But the custodian of these accounts cannot act unreasonably.
Right, and I understand all that. That's what I was wanting to make sure, that the child or individual has the ability to access those funds unless they make the agreement that they want the custodian to have custodial control over them until 25 or 30 or whatever the time frame is you set. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Please.
The next provisions here, this is Section 29. It deals with decedent's remains. And this is an area that Alaska doesn't have statutory coverage. And unfortunately, what we found out in our estate planning section when we had presentations made by funeral directors, it's an area where disputes arise over, you know, who has the power to direct how a person's remains are going to be treated, whether it's going to be burial, whether there's cremation, where it's going to occur, what type of ceremonies are going to occur. It's kind of sad, but that has resulted in significant disputes, not only in Alaska, but these laws have been enacted in a number of other states. So our group put together this provision, which is designed to both make it clear who has the power to make these decisions and also to protect the businesses such as the funeral business people from liability. They've described to us situations where they've just been frozen and they couldn't do anything because people were arguing and they didn't know what the law was and what they should be doing. So this provides authority for a person, just like you would with a will, to execute a form, sign a form, a dispositive document that makes it very clear who has this authority. If a person has not signed such a form, then there's a priority list of the persons who have this authority, who can step up and exercise this authority. Are there any questions?
Representative Chenault.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, could you tell us how that list, I don't really care how it operates. Could you give me a who's top of the list and who's bottom of the list? Just out of curiosity.
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, I'm looking at page 24 of the bill, 1375-020, persons authorized to control disposition. The first one, of course, is the person designated in the document I just referred to. Mm-hmm. If there is no document, then it's the person serving as a personal representative of the person's estate. And after that, then it's the spouse. And after that, it's the sole surviving competent adult child. So it goes through. Mm-hmm. There are actually eight different priorities.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'll ask a question. Dave, is a person serving or nominated by the decedent in the decedent's will, is that the same thing as the executor, or is that a different class of person?
Yes, there really are two ways. I mean, these first two priorities, one would be in the separate form we talked about.
Yeah.
And the second one would be, the second priority is in the will. You know, almost all competently drafted wills will name a person who is the personal representative of the decedent's estate, and that's the person who would handle the probate of the will and is essentially the manager of the estate, and that person would have this authority.
Is that the personal representative the same thing as the executor?
Yes.
Please continue.
Yes. Section 30 deals with insurable interests. This, in order to buy a life insurance policy on someone's life, you have to have an insurable interest. You can't, under most states' laws, go out and just say, well, you know, I think that person doesn't look too good today. I'll see if I can buy a life insurance policy on them and make some money out of it.
Thank
the insurance companies have been very protective about that area. And in 2005, a case was heard in Virginia, in federal court in Virginia, called the Chawla case, which raised some questions as to whether a trustee of a life insurance trust, which are commonly used for estate planning purposes to hold insurance policies, whether that trustee had an insurable interest so that the trustee could buy life insurance on the settlor's life, the person who created the trust. It also raised questions about often insurance policies are held in either partnerships or limited liability companies, again, for the benefit of the family. So because of that, the Uniform Law Commission did a study of this and made amendments to the Uniform Trust Code. And what we have done here is follow those amendments to make it clear that in Alaska, a trustee of a life insurance trust or the general partner of a limited partnership or the manager of an LLC could buy insurance policy on a family member if the beneficiaries are people who would also have insurable interests, in other words, be family members of the person who is insured. So that's what Section 30 does. It clarifies our law, and we're basically just following the amendments of the Uniform Trust Code on the subject.
Well, I would like to interject something at this point in time. In our haste to get the meeting started, we didn't adopt version backslash V, which is the version that we are currently working off of, and I would certainly entertain a motion to adopt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we adopt CS for House Bill 292, designated 27LS1232-B as a working document.
And I'll continue to object for purposes of the remaining discussion on it.
We don't have to start all over, do we?
No. Yeah, we could. I think we have enough time.
It's that kind of day.
I see no objection other than the speaker. No. Backslash B is still before us.
Okay. Section 30. We're in section 30.
Section 30, I think, Dave.
Yes, yes. Actually, 31, I think. We're almost done.
Almost done.
30.
31 deals with transfers of IRA interests. Lifetime estate planning often involves making gifts or sales of other transfers of property to either family members, lower generation, or to trust for their benefit. And this is especially become more and more popular as the state tax law and the gift tax law have changed and allowed for greater amounts to be gifted. What this provision would do would be to allow the transfer of IRA interests to most likely to what's called a grantor trust for the benefit of the employee participants' family members. And as long as that trust was what's called a grantor trust, there would be no adverse tax consequences to this. But what it would allow is for that IRA and the growth of the IRA to be out of the transferor's gross estate for federal estate tax purposes and would save federal estate tax.
Representative Sadler.
I guess I have to ask here, Mr. Chair, through the chair, Mr. David. So this does allow people to transfer their IRA during their lifetime, while they're still alive?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Sadler. That's what it would allow.
Hmm.
If I could expand a little bit, there would be adverse tax consequences if it was done to other than to a grantor trust, which is what I described. You would incur tax immediately. And so very likely this will be used for transfers to a trust. That's an irrevocable trust, but it's one that doesn't have any income tax consequences with respect to transfers, contributions by the settlor of the trust.
Interesting. Do other states, I'm sorry, I'm reading this, do other states allow this at this time already, or?
Through the chair, this is a new provision. As far as we know, this is probably the first time this provision would be enacted.
And is the IRS okay with this, or?
Through the chair, again, before this would be used, we would apply to the IRS for a private letter ruling.
Okay. Keep us posted.
So we could probably do that before we move the bill. Looks like you're almost done, Dave.
And the last one, Mr. Chairman, is on our community property law. In 1998, Alaska enacted an optional community property system. We were the 10th state to enact community property law. They're mostly the western states, Washington, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona. There are Texas, going back east, Louisiana, Wisconsin. The community property concept is a sharing concept between the spouses. Each spouse owns 50% of the property. There is a very attractive income tax benefit to community property. When the first spouse dies, both halves of the community property receive what's called an adjustment of basis, which allows the surviving spouse to sell property without paying capital gains tax. What we have found over the last, 14 years is that we needed some implementation and clarification provisions in our community property law. Community property is unique, and this is true in every state, that property can be classified community property even though title is just in one spouse's name. Like, title may be in the husband's name, but if the husband and wife have agreed, either through a community property trust or a community property agreement, that it's community property, then it will be community property. The 50-50 ownership will override. This statute clarifies that, and this is important for title companies and banks that are dealing with community property. Another clarification has to do with if the property, let's say, is in a form of ownership that is a right of survivorship. An example would be, let's say it's just titled as tenancy by the entireties, which has right of survivorship associated with it, then even though it's also community property, that right of survivorship benefit will apply. And that's a clarification that's been needed. Another situation that's come up commonly is property that has a beneficiary designation. Let's say a lot of bank accounts now will have beneficiary, or brokerage accounts will have beneficiary designations. Well, if one spouse executes a beneficiary designation and says this goes to a certain person, that's only effective for that spouse's half interest unless the other spouse consents in writing. This clarifies that. Now, various family designations, though, are presumed to have been made with the consent of the other spouse. Let's say if you designated the children. But that presumption can be overcome by the surviving spouse's testimony. Also, we found it necessary to clarify the statute of limitations when transfers were made improperly by one spouse of community property without the consent of the other, and to provide remedies for those improper transfers. So this is, I guess, what you could call a cleanup bill that it helps implement our elective community property statutes.
Who's got the first question? Representative Sadler?
Boy, looking at Section 40, Mr. Chair, I've never seen this kind of thing where there is a requirement in a bill for setting a standard for a majority, two-thirds majority of each house. It's in the Constitution. Okay, that's not a question. I actually did another question. But I can't find it, so.
Sorry, back off.
Any further questions? Thanks again, Dave. Doug Black, Blattmacher?
I'm sorry. It came to me.
Representative Sadler.
I'm sorry, sir.
One last question.
Through the chair. Dave, I don't know if you can speak to, there actually, you might not be the right person, but there is a legal memo from Mr. Bannister from Ledge Council, Ledge Legal, about the single subject. This is a pretty broad, lot of moving pieces bill. Have you any comments about the range? Do you have any concerns about this being in violation of our single subject rules?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. Yes, I'm aware of that letter. This is from Terry Bannister at Legislative Affairs, and their job is to point out possible issues. And so we've seen this type of letter in other legislation over the years, and I've talked with Legislative Affairs about this one. All of these are really under Title 13, or predominantly under Title 13. And while this is a possible issue, it's their responsibility to raise all possible issues. It would come up, I guess, if somebody wanted to challenge a part of it. How the Supreme Court would rule is unclear. Their case is going both ways. There's a very practical reason to have everything in one bill, so we don't have a number of the take up your five times of your time and compared to today's testimony.
And actually, I can answer that for you. We are holding the bill over for that reason. We just didn't get that far long enough to bring it up, but we're working with Terry on some clarification on that issue. But I thank you for finding it. Again, thanks again, Dave. And Doug Blotmacher, am I close?
Yes, you are.
Do you have anything to add on this?
Just that
please state your name.
Legislation. We think it's some good additions to what we have, and it'll be advantageous for Alaskans, and we support it and hope the committee will approve it.
Could we get you to state your name and affiliation for the record?
Douglas Blotmacher, and I'm president and CEO of Alaska Trust Company.
And we really appreciate this late in the day, your succinct summary of this, your position on this. Any questions for Doug? Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online? There's no one online. With that, we're going to close out public testimony and hold the bill over until we get a couple points cleared up. And brief at ease. It's our intent to hopefully close out the public testimony on the next item on the calendar, which is House Bill 266, Naturopaths. And we have two people online. Actually, we got three. Jane Madison, are you with us?
Not yet.
Dr. Denier Young. And could you please state your name and affiliation? And I hate to do this to you, but could you limit your comments to about 2 minutes so we can get to all three of the people?
Yes, I can do that. For the record, my name is Dr. Daniel Young. I practiced naturopathic medicine for 20 years. 17 of those years have been in Eagle River, Alaska. I'm currently the vice president of the Alaska Association of Naturopathic Physicians. And I appreciate your time to address this. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 266. To be licensed in Alaska, a naturopathic doctor must have attended a four-year graduate-level naturopathic medical school that is accredited by the Council on Naturopathic Medical Education. The CNME is a member of the Association of Specialized and Professional Accreditors. This body, which is regulated by the U.S. Department of Education, oversees accreditation of allopathic MD, osteopathic DO, and naturopathic ND medical education. Naturopathic doctors are required to pass rigorous NCLEX professional board exams, which include pharmacology and pharmacotherapeutic modules. Naturopathic doctors are educated in all the same basic sciences as a medical doctor, but also study holistic and non-toxic approaches to therapy with a strong emphasis on disease prevention and optimizing wellness. Just as medical or osteopathic doctors are considered to be the experts in their fields, so are naturopathic doctors experts in the practice of natural medicine. We have practiced in the great state of Alaska for 26 years. We have an impeccable safety record. We provide excellent patient care. Anyone who says otherwise is mistaken. Pertinent to the issue before us, naturopathic doctors study pharmacology, how drugs work in the body, and pharmacotherapeutics, how to use drugs therapeutically. Naturopathic doctors also study pharmacognosy, the study of medicines derived from natural sources, which more than prepares them to utilize natural substances in their practices. Further, the required pharmacology board exam ensures entry-level competency. Although our current Alaskan law prohibits, we are well-trained to use natural substances, whether they are prescription or not. Our current statute and the regulations that explain it have had the due force of law. It is not a good statute, but we have been able to function safely within its tenets. You have been well-educated on the history of our statute and regulations by Dr. C.W. Jasper. Over recent years, we have attempted to moderate.
Could you wrap it up, please, Doctor?
Yeah, I'm right at the end.
Perfect timing. Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Young? Jane Madison, are you with us?
Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today. And if you could limit your comments to 2 minutes, we should be able to get the rest of the people out.
I'll certainly try. I'm Jane Madison from Soldotna, and I'm just an interested state resident. I'm speaking today in support of House Bill 266, Naturopathic Care with Some Considerations. As I've listened and read testimony regarding this bill over the past year, I've seen patients in support of naturopathic medicine as the only answer to their health care and wellness. I've also seen medical doctors say that naturopathic providers are not well trained and should not be allowed to practice health care. I believe both of these extreme positions are incorrect. Over the past 7 years, I've had a number of very serious medical issues and have become very familiar with both medical and naturopathic practitioners. I firmly believe that both have a place in the care of Alaskans, and I would like to see them work together. More specifically, I was diagnosed with a variety of endocrine issues. I was treated by an excellent physician's assistant, a wonderful family practitioner, an endocrinologist, and a knowledgeable internist, all of whom helped some. All of them were medical professionals who genuinely cared. They were excellent medical detectives and gave my case a great deal of time and attention. However, none could bring me back to normal. In fact, an endocrinologist actually told me that I had a very serious condition, and they did not have tests for it nor treatment. A physician's assistant actually told me that I may just have to accept the fact that I may never be well again. I then consulted a naturopathic doctor who quickly determined that my endocrine system needed a little boost. One non-prescription pill a day, monitored with monthly blood tests for about a year. Within 1 month, I was back to normal after several years of suffering and heading downhill. The problem is medical doctors really do not know what naturopathic doctors do, and our state regulations limit their practice. Naturopaths should have minimum education requirements prior to licensing in the state, and they should have oversight by a state licensing board, and they should have continuing education requirements, excuse me. They should be recognized and regulated, just like traditional medical professionals, and encouraged to practice alongside the traditional medical community. We hope this bill will help to do that. And I have a second suggestion. A lot of state money and insurance money could be saved if naturopaths had the same prescription authority as physician's assistants. Currently, a patient sees a naturopath for a diagnosis and then goes across the hall to see a physician's assistant or back to a medical doctor to get a prescription. That involves 2 office visits. Do you have any idea how many state dollars are wasted when employees or retirees are billing the state for 2 office visits just to get 1 prescription? Please encourage both sides of medicine and wellness to work together, and please update these regulations and recognize that these practitioners are professionals as well. We thank you for your time and consideration.
Thanks again, Jane, and Speaker Chenault and I are going to be home next week, and we'll be having a town hall meeting at the Borough Assembly chambers at 5 p.m. on Thursday. So I hope we can see you there, and we can talk a little bit more on what's going on at this end. But thanks again for dialing in. Mary Miner, are you with us?
I sure am.
If you could keep it real short, we would love it. And thank you for joining us today.
And honorable members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Mary Miner. I'm a naturopathic doctor in Fairbanks, Alaska. I graduated from Bastyr University as a naturopathic doctor in 1983 and have been in practice for 28 years. I've held licenses in Washington State, Connecticut, and since 1990 in Alaska. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 266, and I'm going to just cut to the chase here. I have been put in this awkward position of having to tell my patients that I cannot treat them with therapies that they know work for them, but I'm cut off from access to these therapies I cannot tell them to go to their conventionally trained providers because their conventionally trained providers doesn't know what these medicines are, what their indications are, or what their counterindications are, and no ethical provider is going to go along with providing a therapy that is outside of their training. And so I urge you with, I just can't tell you how important it is to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and we have one last person actually in the room, David Odinson. Welcome, and thank you for being patient, and you look familiar. I've got a feeling you've been here before.
I have been here before. My name is David Odinson. I'm a consumer of health care. I live at 212 West 9th Street here in Juneau, and actually this is the fourth year that I've been here testifying on some form of bill concerning naturopathy. So I'm hopeful that this year finally something will come of it. I know in the past years the bill has involved an expansion of the scope of practice so it's commensurate with the training that naturopaths have, and this year, you know, they're not really asking for that much. They're just asking to be allowed to practice as they have practiced for the last 25 years. And I think you've heard a lot of testimony from patients, consumers of medical care, saying that they're highly satisfied with the care they get from naturopaths, that, you know, it's high quality care, very effective. And there has not been a shred of testimony from anybody indicating any harm to any patient in this state from naturopaths. I mean, we've heard lots of assertions from doctors. In fact, every year when I come to testify, there's testimony from the Medical Association and a few doctors around the state asserting that the sky will fall if anything like this passes. And, you know, it's just ridiculous. This year, they're only asking to be able to do what they've been doing for the last 25 years. I think it's entirely reasonable to do that, and I think it's just a travesty if something can't be done, because the current situation is intolerable. These naturopaths have been here for many years. Their practices are threatened. Many of them are talking about having to leave the state if something isn't done about the current situation. And I just urge you to pass this bill because, you know, this is low-cost care, it's effective care, and as a consumer, I think, you know, I should have that choice because it's an issue of freedom of choice. I should be able to have this kind of care available to myself and my family.
I hope that you're going to be pleasantly surprised, because I think both sides are, in fact, if you talk to the gentleman sitting behind you, who I've got a feeling you know, he'll tell you that a lot of progress is being made, and we're probably pretty close. We're closer than we've been. And with that, I thank you again for coming. And we've got one late sign up that's in the room. So, Dr. Tim Peterson, if you could join us. And again, we're out of time. So you got 2 minutes.
Do you leave public testimony?
Yeah, I missed the sign up. I'm sorry, I was asleep. I worked last night at the ER. I'll be there tonight. I hope I don't see any of you. I'm an allopathic physician. I've been practicing ER and family medicine in Juneau since 1989, and so I deal with all different people in this community. I just want to reinforce that I know that the first 2 years of the training that most of the naturopaths get is identical to what I had, anatomy, physiology, whatever, and what they choose to do with diagnostics and whatnot later. I respect that that's a difference. I wanted to make a comment about the type of people who go to see naturopaths. They tend to be savvy consumers. Sometimes you have to pay your own money, you have to fight with your insurance to get paid. A lot of these are people with high deductible insurance, but they're people who are good consumers who also understand to shop elsewhere. And I think it's really a matter of choice that a lot of people choose to do this because it just works better for them. In my own life, I had Raynaud's disease, when your fingers turn all white. My colleagues wanted to give me an expensive drug that I had to get liver function tests for, and I wasn't quite ready for that. I came and saw a Harvard-trained naturopath in this town and was very satisfied with the results. So I think it's a matter of choice. In collegiality, I support this bill. I have never in the ER in this town seen anyone come in with any side effects or illnesses as a result of seeing a naturopathic physician. And I think, at least in this town, people, it's we work together. These are not outliers. Some of my colleagues would disagree, and the Medical Association tends to be a little conservative. They can be a little reactive, and I'll tell you right now, I testified 5 years or 6 years ago against the chiropractors in this state wanting to give a lot of prescription drugs because I didn't feel that was appropriate. But I think for these people to continue to do what they're doing, I think they're an asset, and then, as the lady Ms. Holdotten has said, I think potentially we could save money because this is a much cheaper option than come down to my shop and getting a $3,000 CAT scan. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you again. With that, is there anybody else in the room? Seeing none, nobody online. With that, we're going to close out the public testimony. We're going to hold the bill over and adjourn at 5 minutes after 5.